Good evening. My name is Bruce L., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Sean C.
Sean, alcoholic. It's good to be here, good to be sober. Thank you, Mary, for the honor and privilege of speaking. A quick shout out to my AA wife, Morgan, because, you know, that's how we roll. Also, quick shout out to Mary Ann King for 52 years today. It's crazy. She got sober a year before I was born. So we'll talk about the math in a minute, but that's a long time, and I love Mary Ann. Anyway, got a lot to be grateful for. Number one, Andre DeGrasse from Canada beat out three Americans today in the 200. Oh, Canada. Number two, last week I was in Pebble Beach. I got to take seven friends, and we went up there for my 50th birthday that I got to celebrate when I was 51. So a gift of the program is if you want to go play Pebble Beach with friends and have a good time and do that, you can set a goal to do that. And that happened last week. I was really grateful for that. Another thing I'm really grateful for is this is the second week. Both my sisters are in Canada right now, and they're on Zoom tonight for the second week in a row. So that's never happened before, so that's super cool. Thank you, Zoom, for putting that together, because that was never going to happen. So yay, my sisters. And I'm super grateful. I just celebrated 33 years of sobriety, and this is my home group. And it doesn't get any better than this, I can promise you. I had a great day today. I meet friends every week for dinner. And then we come here and do this and go home, and my head's quiet, I'm at peace, and it's all as a result of what you guys taught me what to do 33 years ago. I'm going to talk real fast because 10 minutes. I don't know how to do 33 years in 10 minutes, but here we go. So you'll probably figure out I'm Canadian, and that doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it sure gives me a head start. Growing up in Canada was what it was. It's super cold, and there's really nothing to do in Canada except, drink and play pool and, you know, do other substances. And that's just the way it was for me. And I was one of these where, for me, they talk about an invisible line, and once you cross that invisible line, you can't go back to social drinking. You get right into your alcoholism. And for me, that's what happened pretty much the first time when I started using. I crossed an invisible line. It became my full-time job when I was 14 years old. I was obsessed with it. How to get it, how to get more. People liked me when I seemed to get friends. I could fit in. I could sort of fit in. When you're, 6'1", 128 pounds, you don't fit in too well with anybody. I had chronic case of acne, and I was a band geek. And so I had all kinds of reasons to just, not succeed in life. I got kicked out of two high schools. I had three jobs, couldn't keep a job. And finally, my parents wised up, and they kicked me out of the house one last time. I stole from the people because I didn't work, so I had to steal to maintain my alcoholism and to stay loaded. And I stole from this family. They kicked me out. When it's freezing cold in Canada, you can't survive. So what do? You call mom and dad one more time. So I begged them, please, 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 I'll do anything. They'd gotten wise. They said, sure, come home, and now you got to sign a contract. So, I had thou shalt not steal, thou shalt do your chores, whatever. I can't even remember the list anymore. It was so long ago. But I had to sign a thing. And my intentions were all sincere at that time. I was not going to steal from mom and dad. I was not going to use. I was going to be a good son. I was going to try to do what I said I was going to do. And my intentions were great. And I lasted less than 2 weeks. And I stole money from my mom, and she caught me. So here's what happened. So that next weekend, my mom and dad said, It was like a Saturday or a Sunday. It was on a weekend, and they just said, "Hey, we're gonna go for lunch. We're gonna go for lunch." That's so kind of an odd thing. We never kind of ever did that. But my mom and dad and my two little sisters who were on the Zoom tonight, we piled in a car and we started driving. And we drove. And I know we're past McDonald's. I mean, I have no idea where we're going at this point. And we get to downtown and pull up in front of this house, and these three counselors jump out of the house. And they come out to the car, and this is all I remember. I'm sure there's a lot more my mom and my sisters can fill in, but this is what I remember. So two counselors, one took my family in the house, and these two counselors took me for a walk around the block. And all I remember them saying is the following: "Do you think you have a problem?" They didn't say with what. They just said, "Do you think you have a problem?" And I'm like, well, let's see, I got no job, kicked out of two high schools. I don't really have a place to live. I just stole from my parents. I got a problem. And they said, "Great, do you want to do something about it?" Sure, what'd you have in mind? They said, "Well, there's this 28-day program. It's down by the beach in California. There's lots of women, and the Canadian government will pay for it." I'm in. So I can't remember if it was a week or two, somewhere around there. I was loaded out of my mind. And my mom and I got on the airplane, and it was back then where you could still, I got all the little bottles. So I asked her for the little alcohol bottles on the plane, and I was down in those. And it was the first time I'd been anywhere. So I was kind of excited, and coming into LAX and palm trees. Oh my God, this is going to be so exciting. And I'm nervous, but I'm excited, but I'm loaded, so it doesn't matter. And we get off the airplane, and this van is waiting for us. So we get in this van, and the van starts driving. You got to understand, I don't know nothing. I'm useless. I'm what you call a non-functioning alcoholic. I don't go anywhere. I don't do anything. I can't do anything. I can't function. But I know this. The beach is this way, and we're driving that way. Actually, I think I got it right, too. Yeah, the beach is this way, and we were driving that way. And we're driving, and we're driving, and we're driving, and we pull up in front of this huge hospital. We go up to the fifth floor. My mom goes up to the counter, signs some kind of paper, turns around and walks out. And I got tricked into a 4-month lockup ward at Sentinel Hospital in Inglewood. Thank you, Mom. So that was my introduction to forced sobriety. And I mean, I had nothing. I mean, this place was, I was 128 pounds. I was green and yellow. I was 17 years old. I was just months away from emphysema already. And literally this place just started putting me back together. You know, no caffeine, awful, no cigarettes, even worse, and no sugar. So it was brutal. But every night they brought up panels from AA, NA, and CA to this hospital program. And it was incredible because these panels would come up, and you people, good people, would take time out of your lives to come on these panels. So I got to go so fast here. So long story short, I had to get a sponsor in order to move up through the hospital's level program. And so to get from this level one to level two, I had to pick the sponsor. So it came down to a guy named Keith Jantz and a guy named Todd Morgan. And this is a true story. I picked Todd Morgan. And the only reason I picked Todd Morgan to be my sponsor was because he said he played pool. So whatever your motives are for getting your first sponsor, I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with alcoholism. Mine didn't. The guy said he played pool. I played pool like 10 hours a day. That's my guy. And that's how we related and picked him. Couldn't have been any sweeter or better. That man saved my life. Totally. He worked in Burbank. And you guys know, you live in Burbank, and you're going to go pick up this, at that time now, 18-year-old kid at Sentinel Hospital. That's like a half a day just to get out there, pick the kid up, take him to the AA meeting on Wednesday night, and then get me back by 10:30. I mean, and make sure I was fed. I mean, the guy was amazing, and he did that Wednesday and Saturday. When I got to the time to get out of that hospital program, it was amazing because there was an American family that kind of adopted me in a way, and their son and I became close. And when I was getting ready to have to graduate at 117 days and go back to Canada, the father said to me, "Sean, do you want a job?" And I said, "Sure." This is the best story I can tell you about how my program got started. His father offered me a job working as a receptionist at his real estate company. I had a sponsor in the Pacific Group, Todd Morgan. I had a home group. And a guy in the group offered me a place to stay. And that's why I stayed. And I've never gone home for better purposes. And what's interesting is several thousand kids went through that same hospital program at Centinela. And to my knowledge, there's only two of us that stayed sober the whole time. So the gift of sobriety, I believe, truly is a gift. I don't know if it's a revolving door for you. I don't know if you can keep coming in and out, in and out, in and out. Some people I've seen do this for 33 years, and God bless them. I never felt that I had a revolving door. I saw it, but I didn't think I had it because, one, I thought if I went and got loaded, I'd get abducted and probably deported back to Canada. But that wasn't what really kept me sober. What kept me sober was the activity being in the middle of this group. My sponsor was Larry Garrity, and Larry's sponsor was Clancy. And there was no messing around, man. I was in a line of sponsorship that was in the middle of this group. And so seven meetings a week, seven commitments, the yards, the moves, the watches. I got learning how to play sober softball. I suck. Morgan can attest. Canadians don't play softball. I don't know what I was doing. I throw the glove up. I strike out every time, but I got better, and I started playing. We started playing golf together. We started the PG Golf Tournament. Yay, PG golfers. We got really active into service work with General Service, got active in the Southern California Convention, got active in everything we could possibly do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been treasurer of everything. My higher power has a great sense of humor. I stole my whole career before I got sober, and I get sober, and you know, now as a CFO, I handle hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's money. But let me tell you, I screw up my own money a lot. I've made a lot of mistakes. Not been perfect at all. That's a whole other discussion. If you want to talk about that afterwards, happy to share my horror stories with you. But I will tell you this. I owe everything to the Pacific Group. I owe everything to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe everything to the United States of America. And I can't believe I'm going to tell you this. But 6 weeks ago, I sent in my paperwork for my U.S. citizenship. Now, it only took 33 years, but this freaking country has given me everything, and I love you all for it. Thank you.
Our next 10-minute speaker is Joe B.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 4th of March, 2014. That's March 4th in American. Lydia is my sponsor. She's my sponsor. You guys are my home group. And I had something else to say, but I can't remember, but thank you. Thank you, Mary, for inviting me to speak today, and welcome to the newcomers. That's what I was going to say. Thank you. I don't exactly feel like a great shining example of this program right now, but I can tell you I'm not drinking, so that's pretty big. In case you're wondering, the accent is mostly Australian. I don't want to go into my whole history right now because it's really confusing, but in a nutshell, I grew up in England. My mom's South African. My dad is English, but lived in Canada. And somehow I ended up here about 7 years ago. So I've never known where I was from. It doesn't make me an alcoholic. I think what makes me an alcoholic is how I deal with my emotions and how I deal with the anxiety that I was born with, I believe. I come from a long line of overachievers who are incredibly insecure and believe they're chronic failures, even though they're all doctors, scientists, top of their field. My dad was TV presenter, oncologist, author, and a stand-up comedian, none of which I am, so I'm a bit of failure on every level. But, you know, they all had their isms. They weren't alcoholics, but they all had some sort of obsession or a way that they had to deal with stuff. And my way of dealing with stuff was drinking. It was the only way I could kind of take that pressure off in my head, right? So I probably started when I was about 18 because, you know, I was a goody two-shoes, studious, was going to do the best in school. I think I only did second best, and I only got like 2 prizes for the subjects that I was taking, which was very disappointing to my mother. But, you know, like when I was 18, I really started drinking. I took a year off to travel around Europe and Africa by myself, and I discovered that alcohol made everything a lot easier. And it kept making things easier for a while. But then it kind of got a little depressing, I guess, and difficult. And I just didn't want to stop. I never really tried to control my drinking. If I was going to go out, I was going to drink, and I was going to drink as much as humanly possible. And then I was going to not drink for school nights. But the trouble was, by the time I finished my run, I guess you could call it, was that the school nights were getting further and further apart. And it was like, so I won't drink Monday to Friday. Okay, but I missed the train home. It took me an extra hour. So I need a drink after that. And then by the end of it, it was kind of like, well, I was maybe managing not to drink 2 or 3 times a week, once or twice a week. That doesn't make me any less of an alcoholic, because as soon as I drank, I didn't stop. And I drank to blackout. And what happened is I started doing this course in radio where I became a radio copywriter, and I met this course coordinator, and he was very nice. He was 20 years older than me. He was very overweight. He was diabetic, arthritic, but he was a very nice man, so I married him. And lasted about 4 years, and then we broke up because I thought I might want to have children. When I usually tell this story, at that point, I wasn't having children, and I thought I forgot to have children because I'm in my 40s. I'm about to have a child now. Oh, you guys haven't heard the half of it yet. I'm getting to that. But, yeah, so I like to think it's COVID weight, and I'm about to lose 8 pounds on September 15. But it's getting real now. It's actually a baby. But anyway, I divorced my first husband because of it. And then without him to kind of control and damper things down, things really went off the rails. And I started kind of losing friends and losing people. And I rage quit my job about 30 seconds before I was fired. It was my dream job, working in corporate media production. And I was doing all sorts of creative, fun things like editing and writing and making movies. And so I quit, and then I got a letter from my best friends in the mail, I think you guys call it the post, saying that we couldn't be friends anymore. And I just realized I didn't have anything left, and that I really wanted a drink at Tuesday at 11 a.m. on this bright sunny morning in Melbourne. And I just knew that if I picked it up right then and there, I wouldn't put it down, and I didn't know what was going to happen. So I really want to use my last 5 minutes to kind of talk about early sobriety, because I think it's something that can be really difficult, because for me, I really had to learn a whole new way of processing emotions, because everything I'd done up until I was 18, well, before I was 18, was to use alcohol to mitigate how I was feeling. I either used it to enhance or to dampen or to manage. I used pills because my mum gave them to me because she was a doctor, so it was all right. And it was for my early sobriety, and if you're new, this is totally normal, I've been told. It was death by 1,000 paper cuts. If the bus driver looked at me funny, I was in tears. I couldn't handle anything. I didn't know how to deal with any anger. I was working as a telemarketer doing cold call surveys over the phone, and I was convinced I was about to get fired for not being good enough on the phone, and I was about to throw myself in front of a tram because I was just convinced that this was the end of the world. That's what early sobriety was like for me. Like, I rang my sponsor. I was like, I got to throw myself in front of the chat. I'm going to do it right now. And she said, have a banana smoothie. I'm like, what? She says, go on, have one. And for some reason, I did. And it was really expensive because a hurricane had just dropped had just got rid of all of the crops in Australia and wiped out all of the bananas. So they were like $19 a kilo, which is about $20 a pound, I think, or $30 a pound. So it wasn't exactly a cheap smoothie, right? So I did, and I kind of felt better. And then what I later realized is alcohol is actually sugar. So when you come off alcohol, there's a lot of withdrawal stuff that happens, physical and medical, but a bit of sugar can sometimes help. So there's a tip that no one told me, and I wish I'd known. But for me, what this program has given me, even though I'm not always grateful to be here, it has given me an ability to sit with emotions and to manage life's stuff on life's terms. And like to bring you up to speed here, I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant to a newcomer that I was just in court with on Monday to file a restraining order against because he got physically abusive. So it's not easy. Like, I have not made some good choices, right? And it's been hard. But the thing is that this program has taught me, A, to take it a day at a time. B, to actually talk to people about what I'm feeling. And that was another lesson for me in early sobriety, because I just kept thinking, oh my God, I'm like, if I have to tell someone how I feel and the truth about some situation, you know, the whole world's going to collapse, and it doesn't. And all those little uncomfortable situations and things that are happening in your head, most of them aren't even real. Half the time I talk to someone, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so annoyed. I annoyed them and they're not talking to me. We're not friends anymore. And it's, no, they were having a bad day and they were in the middle of something else when I spoke to them and they didn't even notice, you know. So that's the one thing. And then so I've learned sort of to keep it in the day and take it a day at a time and to ask for help. Like, you know, I'm kind of doing this a little bit on my own. My neighbors have been great. They've been rotating my kitty litter for me and checking it out every day. So now I'm telling them I'm pregnant for 2 years. And, you know, they're helping me pack up. I'm moving to a bigger place. My career is doing pretty okay. You know, like, I'm now a full-time screenwriter and I get paid money to write scripts. And that only happened because I let go of things that weren't working for me and were actually able to focus on it, you know, and you guys taught me how to do that. You taught me how to show up every day, even when I don't feel like writing. I did not feel like writing today. I did 15 pages, you know, because that's what I need to do to get where I want to go. And this is the sort of stuff that you teach me on a day-to-day basis, is just to do what's in front of you and to do the next right thing and to sit in the uncomfortable and learn how to deal with it. And I'm really grateful for that. So thank you for letting me share.
Really, really nice to be here. And always nice to hear a bunch of drunks laugh at the word anonymity. Nobody gets it like drunks, that damn word! So really nice to hear you guys laughing. And there's, that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we just kind of root each other on. You know, in the outside world, some people, I don't know about you, but I get a lot of weird looks. You know, I'm in a lot of people's prayers out there. And in AA, we're like, yeah, all right. Like, the worse we are, the more we are on your team, you know. I love it. This is my home group. I just turned 19 years sober. It's crazy. So bananas. My sobriety date is July 21st of 2002. And I got sober here, and I think, you know, I do love Zoom. I'm glad you mentioned that, Sean. My dad, who just spoke here, I think 3 weeks ago or so, spoke here at Pacific Group, and he's on the meeting tonight in Louisville, Kentucky. So it makes it a pretty cool Kentucky, Canada. It's basically the same place, Sean. Hey, Lydian. Again, Mary, thank you so much for asking me to be here, and it is always, I mean, I roll up. I mean, there's nothing like the people that know you since day one. Doug, you know how rough it was coming in here. You know, you come in here and you're new, and you're like, she doesn't look like an alcoholic. You know, ask somebody who was here on day one, and they will tell you, you know, like a lot of us. And, you know, I didn't come in here, oh my God, didn't even own a dress. You know, living out of your car isn't really a, doesn't go hand in hand with having nice attire, you know. So if you're new here and everybody looks great, you know, there's a long way between day one and from my, you know, from just my experience, 19 years. Like, everybody is kind of infamous in this group, you know. Keith P., who I don't see here tonight, but, you know, he called me and, damn it, Keith! You know, he called me an unmade bed for the first 10 years of my sobriety. God! You know? I'm 19, I heard that for the next 5 years. Every, you know, I'd walk by and be like, unmade bed, you know, underneath their breath. I was like, wow, I love my home group. Great, keeping it humble. You know, so I love things like that. And, you know, and Patrick S., who, you know, is a member of this group, and for a long time, you know, I wore basically trash cans on my feet that I called shoes, you know. And one day, I think I was like, I don't know, 4 years sober, and he looked at my feet and he said, Sarah, we are going shopping for some new shoes, buddy. And I was like, what? You know, so we went up to, I don't remember the shoe store, one of the cheap ones or whatever. And, you know, he made me, I took off those shoes, we bought a new pair of shoes, and he made me take these shoes off my feet. He called like sofa cushions, basically, because they were, you know, coming out of the seams. And he made me put it on the trash can outside of the shoe store. And he said, you deserve to have good shoes, Sarah. It is very, you know, shoes are important. And, you know, and it's like, what does that story have to do with anything related to sobriety or Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, a drinking? It has everything to do with it. You know, for me, even when I got sober, you know, it took me a long time to recognize any sort of confidence or taking up space or the, you know, just the knowing that I deserve to have good shoes, you know. And, you know, and that really kind of those actions that have been taken with me in my home group by, you know, Pacific Group home group members has really changed not just my sobriety, but it's changed my life. And nobody could have given that to me by saying anything like, oh, you know, lift up, giving me a positive affirmation. You know, it was an action by another drunk that I knew exactly who he knew where I came from and I knew where he came from. And I trusted that. And because of that, you know, I've been able to do that for people behind me. And I definitely, you know, I own shoes that are relatively decent today. Not because I like shoes. But, you know, but dang it, I deserve a soul, you know, like a soul. I deserve that. And so anyway, to back it up, you know, so thank you. I love you guys. And, you know, I never thought I'd be speaking a main speaker Pacific group, believe me. And but you know what? You stay sober, you stay alive. Eventually you'll make it up to this podium. And I did. Stayed alive, Mary. And with us, it's a, you know, 50-50. So, I love alcohol. I will tell you that right off the bat. I have an, you know, a pretty abnormal, just with the physical appearance of alcohol, just, you know, and it's proven to me time and time again, the longer that I stay sober, the more I realize I don't have a normal reaction to alcohol. I was even talking to a Cassie, a newcomer, even to this day. I'm 19 years sober. I already drank my speaker water. It's done. I had to bring up my own home water. I already drank it. Like 30 ounces of water. It was gone in 2 seconds. I was like, I forgot my, you know, I already drank my water. I couldn't even standing up here so glistening. And I was like, Brian, I need that water. And, you know, I still have 4 drinks with me to this very day, whether it's a water, a coffee, sparkling water. I got Crystal Light. You know, I got all of them. I need to stay hydrated. And abnormally hydrated. But I was driving on the street, and I came to this, I was at a stoplight. And I'm telling this story because, again, no matter how long I'm sober or how far away I am from physical alcohol, I'm always reminded of, you know, kind of the power of just the substance of alcohol. I was taking a left, and there was a guy that was had 2 6-packs of glass long neck beers in his hand, and he was swinging them because he's pumped, you know. He's got a 12-pack and an open mouth, you know. I was like, I gotcha. And so he's, you know, swinging these things, and I'm waiting for him to cross a crosswalk, and all of a sudden, the bottom of these 6-packs falls out. All 12 long neck glass beers hit the pavement, out. And I was like, you know, I was like, oh my God, you know, like, oh my God. Oh my God. You know, like he dropped a newcomer, like new baby, like a newborn baby. That's how devastated I was, like, oh my God. And, you know, and I looked at him and he looked at me. I was like, you all right? You know, like, you need help? You know, like, I really, you know, he kind of, you know, squandered about, like, oh, you know, trying to, but I thought about that for the next 5 miles, you know, like, what? What's he going to do? You know, is he going to go back in and get aluminum because it's safer? It's airtight, you know, like, what are you going to do? Sorry, tapers, I clapped. But I did, you know, I thought about that for a while down the road and, you know, about different scenarios of what he was going to do and not do, if he was going to go back to Gelson's or go to Trader Joe's, get the cheap stuff. You know, I really, for far too long. Like, it didn't need to go on that long in my head, you know, but it did, you know. Just little reminders like that of, you know, just physical alcohol in the morning that takes place when I see it not consumed properly, you know. Even in normal drinkers to this very day, I'm like, oh, God, you're not doing it right, you know, like, just drink it all, you know. And so, you know, and coupled with that, the kind of obsession with just alcohol, you know, growing up, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and I always say that for my fellow Kentucky people in here, and Jeff Blair, wherever you are, and, you know, I just knew that even as a young kid, you know, that as of myself, I wasn't enough, like, of myself, it wasn't going to work out for me for whatever that crooked, broken spirit that I had. And again, nobody instilled that in me. Like, I intuitively knew. And here's how I knew that. You know, far before I ever took a drink, you know, it was first grade, we had to bring in a baby picture of ourselves to school. And on the bottom of the picture, we had to put how long we were and how much we weighed. And I remember, now, I weighed 9 pounds as a baby, which I thought was far over baby weight. And because the two most popular girls weighed a solid 6. So I was like, I can't weigh 9 pounds. That's massive. That's the size of a turkey. I cannot do it. I cannot. And so first grade, man, and I had the picture out the next morning about ready to go to school. And, of course, you know, my mom writes in 9 pounds because she's a proud mother. You know, that is a lot to carry. So she puts that in there, and I took a big Sharpie marker, and I scratched out 9 pounds, and I put 2 pounds. Perfect. And she saw it, and she said, Sarah, you can't be 2 pounds. You'd be almost dead. And, you know, I thought, perfect. You know what I mean? I was like, that's a great story. You know, again, never had a drop. So I took the picture in, even though, you know, she warned me of that I would need to have some sort of mortality story, you know, attached to this 2-pound weight. I was prepared, you know, because I was like, well, you know, I'll just lie. So I stood up in front of the class, and I went on this whole tangent, as only a good alcoholic, you know, blooming alcoholic could, and I went on this whole thing, and I said, you know, when I was born, I weighed 2 pounds. Turns out, there was this kid in my class named Nick Wickey, and Nick came up to me, and he said, oh, man, I was 2 pounds too when I was born. I was so sick I almost died. What happened to you? You know, I remember just lose baby weight. You know, I was like, oh, well, I was born without this bone here. And I have my kidneys. Don't got any of those. Those are gone. You know, like, I just started losing baby weight quick. And the problem with that is that I carried that lie for the next 8 years at that grade school. And the whole time we were known as the 2-pound twins. And I let it rip. I never corrected somebody, not over 7 or 8 years in that grade school. I mean, I know Nick really well. He still lives in Louisville. Since told him I weighed, you know, I tapped on 7 more pounds, you know. I since have told him. But, you know, again, you know, that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of spiritual, they call it in Alcoholics Anonymous, a spiritual malady. Very fancy. But other, you know, what I just knew is that, you know, I hated myself and whatever I got to do to feel just equivalent to you for 1 second, I'm going to do it, you know. And so, and also come from, you know, you heard my dad spoke, I was, you know, raised in a alcoholic home where, you know, man, several divorces. They've had, I don't know, pop, like 3 or 4 divorces, 11 separations. And don't worry, they got married for the 5th time 19 years ago. So they call it their gross net wedding anniversary. So now they've been married for 50 years total. The gross, they don't know what the net is, so they say. And, you know, that does not make me an alcoholic. It made me uncomfortably single for longer than I would have chosen. But fortunately, did not make me drink the way I did. But, you know, and I say that, you know, it's just we always had alcohol in the house. You know, it was really simple. The drunks looked like they were having a great time. And you go, I got my mom over there who doesn't drink a drop. And she's not looking like she's having a great time. So the choice was easy. You know, like the teeth gritter or you know, the dude who's lubricated. And he looks smooth, you know. And so it was an easy decision. You know, there was nothing not wrong with the way that alcohol presented itself and the ease and comfort that it brought. You know, like it really wasn't a tough choice. And so, you know, I started drinking when I was a common age, I think in AA, about 12 years old. And all the 12-year-old drunks laugh. I mean, yeah, I guess we're all 12. I don't know. But nonetheless, we were young. And, you know, it's not that, of course, when I was 12, did I get a DUI? No, because I couldn't drive. You know, like, there was things, many things that led up to what landed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I talk a lot about my, even before I drink, because of, you know, the spiritual soul sickness that we talk about here. And, you know, my first kind of recognition, I grew up in the church, and I remember, you know, the priest said to us, and again, this has nothing to do with outside anything. This was just my experience growing up there. But, you know, I remember he pointed to this dude, and I already told you kind of what's going on the inside. You know, I got a brain that's always thinking about me, and if I'm not thinking about me, I'm thinking about you. What you thinking about me? And it's never, you know, my world is very small, because I will tell you, by that time, it was already all about me. And so the guy would get up there, and he'd say, all right, everybody, this is your dude right here. This is the all-powerful one. Do right by this dude, and you'll be all right for the rest of your life. You know, and I looked at him even at an early age, and I was like, well, he looks very tired, and he looks hungry. And, you know, he needs a snack, and he does not look like he has his eye on the ball. So, you know, I kind of put those two and two together of like this, you know, this is going to have to be something between me and me, you know. And, you know, when you drink like that, there's not a lot of room for anybody else or anything else divine or any sort of intervention that's going to become between me and drinking. So when I started drinking, you know, it was something that it was just tranquil, and it made sense. And for the first time in my life, you know, I was able to look you eye to eye. We were all equal. I wasn't better than and I wasn't less than you, but I could definitely be with you. You know, and as we all know now, you know, that was an alternate reality that actually wasn't happening. It was fantasy, you know, but I'd rather live there than in, you know, in sobriety where I knew for me, you know, it was uncomfortable and I hated it and I hated myself and I hated the way that, you know, I hate how much I even thought about myself because that was all I thought about. And, you know, so basically, you know, and I got sober young and, you know, in high school, you know, I drank. Here's the deal. You know, I hung out with other people who were exactly like me. I never hung out with valedictorians. I didn't hang out with anybody of the do-gooders. You know, I wasn't, you know, rubbing elbows, you know, with the valedictorian trying to write her speech. You know, like I was on the other side. You know, even at that time, early as, you know, young as I was, you know, I already had people that were, you know, dying and they were having, you know, heart attacks from cocaine, that people were dying of suicide because they try to stay sober, people were dying in car accidents, you know. And so, and as you guys know, you know, for me, you know, if you're hanging out with people who are all doing what you're doing, you don't look like you're doing so bad, you know, like, period. We're all like, you know, takers. And if eventually we're all like, you know, one side of the Velcro. In most relationships, you got the give and the take. But alcoholics, for me, the people I hung out with, we were all just one side of the Velcro. All the take side, we just fell out, you know. Period. And so, you know, I went on to Chicago. You know, I went on to art school up there. And it was really simple. And by that time, I was already drinking. There had been consequences for my drinking. You know, I had a DUI. I had all that. And didn't mean much to me, really. That was just, you know, a byproduct of being in the wrong place, wrong time, you know. And I went up to school. And I did, you know, I did really well. Like, I actually, not really well at school, but I tried really hard to get into that school. And I got into the Art Institute up there. And I made it there for, you know, a year and one quarter. And it was really simple. You know, the deal was I went to school and I wasn't the best. And if I ain't the best, I ain't playing. So I dropped out. Period. Like, there's nothing in my alcoholic brain who's like, hey, Highland, why don't you do the work? Do homework. Like, do what they say, do the work, and get better. No, my solution at that time, you know, was you're not the best, so I ain't playing, and I'm dropping out. But you know what I'm good at, and you know what always is there waiting for me when I get back to give me a warm hug is alcohol. Period. I didn't have to compete with alcohol. Didn't make me feel less than or worse than. Alcohol did exactly what it was supposed to do. It shut my brain up, just like, you know, Sean talked about. You know, it's like I shut my brain up, and it eased my stomach. And it just made me feel with. It made this life, this being, this spirit tolerable long enough to kind of get me to the next drink, really. So, you know, in Chicago, I stayed there for like another 3 years. And my drinking took, you know, it took a pretty bad turn out there. And along with my alcoholism, I also developed, you know, an eating disorder. And that was really simple. You know, it was simple because I removed an obstacle, which was food, that got in the way of alcohol. You know, because I came, you know, just a clear vessel for alcohol so that it could saturate any and every pore that I had that was uncomfortable. And so, you know, so by the time that I moved out to L.A., you know, I'm 5'9 now. I weighed about 100 pounds when I came out to Los Angeles. Like, I've gotten some applause for that in West Hollywood, you know, and I'm like, that is not healthy. Mm-mm, that's not even cute, you know, like, that's almost dead. Now, that's almost dead. And so, you know, I came out here. And it's funny, you know, people all the time, normal or not normal, you know, have asked me like, oh, well, why did you come to Los Angeles? And we never have, you know, it's never for some on a road to success. I was like, look, we just took a right, you know, like took a right, kept going. And that was it. There was no, you know, there was nothing, there was no goal line. There was just kind of, you know, a bunch of alcoholics floating in the wind going to the next drink. And, you know, so when I made it out to Los Angeles, I was here for about 9 months before I got sober. And like I said, you know, my health was deteriorating. It's been a long road in my dental situation, even into sobriety. I'm missing a few, actually, you know, because my teeth are falling on my head. It was, you know, and basically the bottom line is same thing. And I wish my alcoholic story involved some sort of helicopter crash or something, but it doesn't. You know, it's just a low grade, depressing, horrible, lonely, pathetic, slow nosedive, you know, like, you know, hell, like, I moved out here, and I was with a bunch of other drunks who were drinking like I did, you know, again, that pattern never changed, and so, you know, what happened, and what I told you about, you know, my dad, who was sober early on, I think what happened for me, you know, why Alcoholics Anonymous and is such a family disease, because I'll tell you, you know, the guy that I talked about, you know, and he's a lot of his story. I mean, he was in and out of nut houses growing up. I mean, half of my Christmas presents growing up were from wood shop at the nut house. It had... And they never had screws in them because you couldn't, you know, so they'd fall apart pretty... Pretty easy. It's a tool. It's a weapon. So, you know, I grew up with this man, you know, who was crazy. And, he went, our nut house was called Our Lady of Peace. And on the bottom of all my wood toys, he would put Olap 86. And I was like, I just thought it was the elves. You know, I was like, I love them Olap elves. Nobody told me. But the good news is, the fun thing is that, you know, he made a baby carriage for me once for my preemie baby doll. And he re-gave that gift. He re-gifted that gift and gave it to me as my wedding present a couple years ago, which I thought was pretty cool. And anyway, so, but the deal is, you know, I watched... Alcoholics Anonymous started working in my life before I even knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And it was out of sheer example, because Alcoholics Anonymous, I always talk about in the traditions, attraction rather than promotion. Attraction, what is that? Well, I'll tell you, you know, it worked in my life, because like I said, my life was not going well. And I was on the verge of dying, just physically, my body, was not able to take the toxicity that, you know, was happening to it, period. And, but what happened for me is that, you know, I was left alone in my car. It was a Ford Bronco farm truck, and it was me and my dog, Willis. And what happened is that, you know, I knew one example of sobriety in my life, and that was my old man. That was my dad. And he didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't sit us down and give us bedtime stories of his meetings. Like, I watched a man who was violent and angry and, you know, in and out of our lives constantly. And every, you know, when he got sober, there was a transformation that happened to him. And I watched it. I watched it like a hawk, you know, like I watched, like I said, I grew up watching this, you know, overly lubricated situation, which looks seamless, you know, and I, you know, it took a turn like alcoholism does, you know, but I watched him. And so, and I knew that my dad, you know, had become somebody because of AA, because of sobriety, because of the people he sponsored, because of the actions he took, you know, in our home as a father. And, you know, when my time came, out here in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, I wish my last drink had been something more of an exotic excursion, you know, I really do, if somebody would have told me, but it was the same old, you know, boring drunk that I've always had, and somebody asked me to go have a drink, and I knew I should have said no, but I said yes, and once again, I landed on the side of the road in Studio City, actually, and it was just me and Willis, and I woke up the next morning, and that was June 19th, actually. I woke up that morning, and I knew that I was tired. Like, I knew, you know, whatever, and Sharon C. talks about all the time, the ember of life, the ember of life, the ember of life. And he's like, the ember is this little burning burning little thing that we have. And if you put a little, blow on it just a little bit, it'll ignite just a bit of a flame. And I'll tell you, like when I was sitting in that Bronco with me and Willis, man, that's all I had. It is all I had. And so, you know, I did something that us drunks don't do. You know, I called and I extended a hand for help. And again, I didn't know what I was going to get back in return, but it wasn't because I wanted to, and it wasn't because I wanted to be a better person. I really wanted to be there for my family. It was none of that. It was, as all of us know, a divine intervention, like, period, because it had nothing to do with me. Because for me, all I know is I could not, the conundrum for most of us in my experience is that I couldn't imagine continuing to live and drink, but I also couldn't imagine continuing to drink and live the way that I was living. There was no, as Clancy called it so many times, there was no friendly direction, not even in my own head, like let alone like physical things helping, like just in my own 365 head, you know. And so, you know, I picked up the phone and I said, you know, I'm tired. And and you know what? He was a good member of AA, and he, you know, didn't come out and save me. And I know there's a lot of parents in here that, you know, have kids who are drinking or getting sober or whatever it is, or dying, you know, whatever it is. But he didn't get on a plane. He didn't do anything. All he said, if you want to get sober, really, you know, I'll give you a number to a guy I know out there. And if you want to call him, then you call him. And he hung up the phone and he gave me the number to Scott Redmond out here. And I didn't know Scott. Scott didn't know me, you know, but I had one divine tool that was given to me from another drunk, let alone my father, just another drunk. And again, another divine action happened. I called Scott. Another divine thing. Scott picked up the phone. That's big. You know, like another drunk picked up the phone. And, you know, because Scott took that action, you know, that is my responsibility that I do that to this very day in my sobriety. Because of him. Because of the example. And again, Scott didn't know me. Only thing Scott knew is I was an alcoholic who needed help, and if I wanted his help, he was happy to be there. And, you know, I talked to him, and he said, do you think you can stay sober till tomorrow morning? There's a meeting at 9 a.m. at the log cabin. And of course, I had nothing going on. I was like, well, me and Willis are just hanging out, you know. So I drove. I didn't have any money left either. I had like a flip phone at that point. And so, you know, the next morning I drove – I drove my home over the hill to the log cabin, and I met up with Scott, and that wasn't my sobriety date. You know, I here's the deal. You know, I went in and I really did not think they meant everything. They mean everything. Like I really like, because it said Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, so I just thought everything wet. If it's not, if you can't drink it, you're fine. You know, like I just made up that rule in my head because I really cannot wrap my brain around everything, you know, because I really looked at you. I was like, sober? Like sober, sober? Like sober, you know, like, you know. And so I changed my date is July 21st. And that's because, you know, in that time that I was in the rooms, you know, I got a sponsor. Her name was Jennifer R. at the time. It's now Jennifer W. I think she lives in Oklahoma now. But we were talking on the phone, and, you know, she said to me, what are you taking? I was like, how does she know? You know, like, so she said, I want you to bring everything that you're taking and bring it to Thursday Night Key Group. And I did. I put all my little pills and everything, little weed, you know, everything that was that was without liquid. And she took them and she said, your sobriety date is going to be July 21st. And that was the day that I surrendered, you know. And I remember I told her that day, standing in the parking lot outside of Key Group, I was like, look, you know, if I can't sleep, you got to just hold on tight, like put them in like a locked thing, because I don't want to die on your watch, you know, like. And she took about 10 years to tell me that she flushed them down the toilet like that night, you know what I mean? I was like, smart move. And so, you know, what happened is from that point on, you know, July 21st, getting sober for me was not easy. I had this idea in my head that, you know, once I got sober, I was supposed to just be happy all the time, right? Don't you get, like, spiritual and, like, happy all the time? You know, you come in here and, like, everything changes. And the thing is, I came in with the mentality, you know, that AA was supposed to fix it. I was like, well, fix it. You know, I do what you told me to do. I stopped drinking. Now fix me, you know. And I'd always go to my sponsor and I would tell her, all right, look, I'm not happy. And she would say, Sarah, you know, go get a greeting commitment. Show up to the meeting early. And I was like, okay, you know, and I did that. And I'd come back to her 5 minutes later. I was like, well, I did your greeting commitment. I'm still not happy. She'd give me another direction. And it would go on like this. I did your step and I'm still not happy. And so finally she said to me, she said, Sarah, for an alcoholic like you, happiness is overrated. You find usefulness, you will find happiness. And you know what? That really changed. Again, not just my sobriety, but my life. She's basically saying, stop being a taker. You know, and that is the moment, you know, that I started being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got my first commitment. Because I'll tell you, you know, no one was more comfortable with being useless than me, you know? It's crazy. I see teenagers now that I'm like, is that what that was? I was like, wow. But I was grown. And so, you know, she said, you need to get a commitment. And so I got a commitment at a Thursday night as the cake girl. And I tell you, that changed everything. She was a smart sponsor. She said to me, she says, now, Sarah, cakes are important. And if you don't show up to your cake commitment and you don't do what you got to do and bring the cake to the birthday people, they're going to drink and die. I was like, dang. And I have that on my shoulders. I got enough going on, you know, like, So I made that cake. She was smart. She was another drunk. She knew how to communicate to another drunk. And so what happened to me is I made that cake commitment the most important thing in my life. You know, I would drive to Ralph's and I would stand in front of the cake section for like 2 hours. You know, I was like, well, chocolate or vanilla, lemon or raspberry. You know, I would go, God, it's been so much time. And then so I'd go get this cake, and so proud of the cake. I'd, you know, light the candles how we do, and I would have a whole cake section. And the birthday person would go get it, and they'd blow out the candles, and I'd watch them, and I was like, because of me, it's because you're alive. You're welcome. That's crazy, you know. That, again, she tapped into the ego of the alcoholic. But what happened inadvertently is that I started to, this was now my job. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, I'm useful as all get up. I'm keeping people alive one birthday at a time around here. And it became, you know, so what happened, you know, it always, Alcoholics Anonymous is so cool. It's so cool. This is the only program I know that knows how to talk to alcoholics, and Bill and Bob are really smart. That was my timer. Sorry, because I keep my own. Okay. So it reminds me of how the sponsorship relationship works with sponsees, because this is how it has worked, especially in the Pacific group, because of all the actions that we take here to feel and think differently. And it reminds me of, Hilda, of the movie Karate Kid. I don't know if everybody's seen this movie, but, you know, my sponsor often was like Mr. Miyagi, and I was a lot of time Daniel-san. You know, I'd go, like in the movie, Daniel-san goes up to Mr. Miyagi, right? He's like, hey, Mr. Miyagi, I got a tournament coming up. I got to learn a few moves. You got to teach me. And so Mr. Miyagi would go, okay, kid, I want you to go paint the fence. And Daniel-san was like, did you hear what I said? I have a tournament. You got to teach me some moves, you know. And he said, yeah, paint my fence like this. And then Karate Kid goes and paints a face, huffing and puffing. Like, that old man, you didn't hear what I said. You know, like, just does that. Comes back the next day. He goes, all right, man, no, for real. Like, it's, like, around the corner. I got to learn something here. And then Mr. Miyagi goes, great, wax my car. Wax on, wax off. See that move? Wax on, wax off. Daniel-san's like, I hate you. I hate you so much. I'm going to get killed. You know, I'm going to get killed. But he goes and he waxes his car, and Daniel-san, or, and Mr. Miyagi's all quiet, like, mm-hmm. And so, and as we all know, Daniel-san goes to this tournament. He's in a little circle. And what are the two moves that, you know, win him the tournament? Wax on, wax off, and paint the fence. And it's kind of like the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go to my sponsor, and I'm like, hey, you know what, man? This girl at my job, she gave me the stink eye. I'm going to quit. I'm going to punch her in the face, and then I'm going to quit. That's what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to live on the street. And then I'll probably just do coke. You know, like, it just goes on. That's my idea. That's my winning thoughts. And so, and you know, my sponsor says, okay. Well, how about you go get a coffee commitment first, and we do that step four. How about you do a little writing? And I'm like, did you hear what I said? I said, punch her in the face, you know, and I go through my whole plan. But the deal is, I go and do the direction that my sponsor says, and I do the writing, and I do the steps, and I do what we do here in AA. And you know what? For me, the tournament, the moves I learn here is exactly what I take into the world. And I am, you know, a functioning member, not just the outside functioning stuff. Like, that's nothing to do with it, really. It's all byproducts of feeling better. But, you know, the things that I have on the inside, again, I'll bring Clancy into it when he, and it really worked for me, is that he said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous does us for us slowly what alcohol did for us so quickly. And that has been 100% my story. You know, I've given so many tools and things and love and unconditional love and alcoholic, you know, the way that we speak to one another, spirit to spirit, you know, and I've been able to live out there in the world and win tournaments. I'm just joking. Win tournaments. But I do all right out there. So thank you guys so much for letting me share. Thank you.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. And if you're taking a cake tonight, come here to the right of the stage and line up in order of sobriety. If you're taking a cake online, please email Kimberly K, who's right here, at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon Wednesday deadline. Hybrid birthdays will be shown after in-person birthdays. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. See my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. And now we are going to sing briskly, I guess, I don't know, and speak briefly. Okay. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. So our first birthday tonight is for Susan P. for 13 years.
Susan Alcoholic, I want to thank my wonderful sponsor, Lydia, God, and all of you.
Sorry. Oh, Lord. I got lost in the cakes. All right. For 14 years for Patty C.
Hi, Patty Crookshank, alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my beautiful sponsor, Lydia, my husband, John, Paula and Susan, and the class of 07. Thank you.
Our next birthday is for 26 years for Lydia W.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lydia. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank my sponsor, Rhonda, for giving me that cake and for always being in my corner. I want to thank the women that I sponsor. I want to thank Clancy for all he's done for us. I want to thank Paul for the loving, incredible, sober home that we have shared together for 25 years. And I want to thank the Pacific Group and all of you.
And our next birthday is for a former secretary of the Pacific Group for 52 years, Marianne Kay.
I would like to acknowledge Mize H., Alice C., and Betty H. for mentoring and sponsoring me in my early days of sobriety. And a special thanks, of course, for our beloved Clancy, the founder of this group, who was my sponsor for many years until his passing. And now I would like to thank Pat, who has taken on my case, and it really is a case, because I'll tell you what, I love long-term sobriety, but being an old woman is not easy. Thank you guys for making it a little bit easier, and a special thanks to Pat for sponsoring me and helping guide me when I get confused. Thank you. I love you all. Thank you so much.
So we have some Zoom birthdays. We have a three-year birthday for Simone T. and Patty C. is her sponsor. We have a 29-year birthday for Lloyd S. and Tom B. is his sponsor. We have a 36-year birthday for Jillian V. and Rita S. is her sponsor. And we have a 37-year birthday for Wayne B. and Tom B. is his sponsor. Okay, we have some special announcements tonight. As you all know, and that masks are required